and he ordered potato wedges and a cheeseburger as rare as the health department would allow. When Beverly had disappeared into the kitchen with his order, he sipped his beer. Something was off. It was flat, and aside from the faintest suggestion of bitterness in the finish, almost completely devoid of taste. He set the pint glass on the bar as Beverly returned. "I'm getting a free meal, so I'm hesitant to complain," he said. "But something's wrong with this beer." "Really?" She gestured to the glass. "You mind?"
"Go ahead."
She lifted the glass and took a sip, licked the foam off her upper lip as she set it back down.
"Tastes fine to me."
"Really?"
"Yeah."
"No, it's flat, and I don't know. It's just, it doesn't have any taste."
"Weird. I don't get that at all.
Do you want to try a different beer?"
"No, I probably shouldn't be drinking anyway. I'll just have a water."
She got him a fresh glass, squirted water over the ice. He lifted a steaming hot cheeseburger from his plate with both hands. Beverly was wiping down the other end of the bar when he called her over, the burger poised in front of his mouth.
"What's wrong?" she asked.
"Nothing. Yet. Come here." She came over, stood facing him. "My experience," he said, "is that about 80% of the time when I order a hamburger rare like I just did, I get one well done. I don't know why most cooks are incapable of cooking a hamburger the right way, but there it is. And you know what I do when I get one overcooked?"
"You send it back?"
She didn't look amused.
"Exactly.
You're pretty goddamn difficult to please, you know that?"
"I'm aware," he said, and dove in.
He chewed for a good 10 seconds.
"Well?" Beverly asked.
Ethan set the burger back on his plate, swallowing as he wiped his hands on the linen napkin. He pointed at the burger.
"That's an amazing piece of work."
Beverly laughed and rolled her eyes. By the time Ethan had finished the last crumb on his plate, he was the only customer left in the restaurant. The barkeep took his plate away and then came back to refill his water.
"You gonna be all right tonight, Ethan? Got a place to stay?"
"Yeah, I sweet-talked the desk clerk at the hotel into letting me have a room."
"She bought your bullshit story too, huh?"
Beverly smirked.
"Hook, line, and sinker."
"Well, since this is on me, can I offer you dessert? Our death by chocolate is out of this world."
"Thanks, but I should probably get going."
"What is it exactly that you're doing here? In your official capacity, I mean? I understand if you can't talk about it. It's a missing persons investigation."
"Who went missing?"
"2 Secret Service agents."
"They disappeared here? In Wayward Pines?"
"About a month ago, Agent Bill Evans and Agent Kate Hewson came here on a classified investigation. As of this evening, they haven't been heard from in 10 days. A total loss of contact, no email, no phone calls. Even the GPS tracking chip in their company car went dark."
"And they sent you to find them?"
"I used to work with Kate. We were partners when she lived in Seattle."
"Is that all?"
"Excuse me?"
"Just partners?"
He could feel a tremor of something, sadness, loss, rage, vibrating through him. But he hid it well.
"Yeah, we were just partners. Friends too, though. Anyway, I'm here to pick up their trail, find out what happened, bring them home."
"You think something bad happened?"
He didn't answer, just stared at her. But it was an answer.
"Well, I hope you find what you're looking for, Ethan."
Beverly pulled a check out of the front pocket of her apron and slid it across the bar.
"So this is my damage, huh?"
Ethan glanced down at the check. It wasn't an itemized bill. Beverly had handwritten an address across the columns. 604 First Avenue.
"What's this?" Ethan asked.
That's where I live. If you need anything, if you run into trouble, whatever.
What? You worried about me now?
No, but with no money, no phone, no ID, you're in a vulnerable state.
So you believe me now?
Beverly reached across the bar, let her hand rest on top of his for just a second.
I always believed you.
Outside the pub, he took off his shoes and started down the sidewalk in bare feet, the concrete cold, but at least he could walk without pain. Instead of going back to the hotel, he followed one of the streets that intersected Main and headed into a neighborhood, thinking about Kate. Victorian houses lined both sides of the block, set off by the glow of their porch lights. The silence was staggering. You never got nights like this in Seattle. There was always the distant moan of some ambulance or car alarm, or the patter of rainfall on the streets. Here, the complete, dead quiet was broken only by the soft slap of his feet against the pavement. Wait. No, there was another sound, a solitary cricket chirping in a bush up ahead. It took him back to his childhood in Tennessee, and those mid-October evenings, sitting on the screened porch while his father smoked his pipe, staring across the soybean fields when the chorus of crickets had dwindled down to a lonely one. Hadn't the poet Carl Sandburg written about this very thing? Ethan couldn't recall the verse verbatim, knew only that it had something to do with the voice of the last cricket across the frost. A splinter of singing. There it was. That was the phrase he'd loved. A splinter of singing. He stopped beside the bush, half expecting the chirping to abruptly stop, but it kept on at a rhythm so steady it almost seemed mechanical. Crickets rubbed their wings together to make that sound. He'd read that somewhere. Ethan glanced at the bush. Some species of juniper. Strong, fragrant smell. A nearby streetlight threw a decent splash of illumination down onto the branches, and he leaned in to see if he could catch a glimpse of the cricket. The chirping went on, unabated. "Where are you, little guy?" He cocked his head. Now he was squinting at something barely poking up between the branches. But it wasn't the cricket. Some sort of box instead, about the size of his iPhone. He reached through the branches and touched the face of it. The chirping grew softer. He took his hand away, louder. What the hell was the point of this? The chirp of the cricket was emanating from a speaker. It was nearly 10:30 when he unlocked his hotel room and stepped inside. He dropped his shoes and stripped naked and climbed into bed without even bothering to turn on the lights. He'd cracked one of the windows before leaving for dinner, and he could feel a thin, cool draft breezing across his chest, driving out the day's stuffy accumulation of heat. Within a minute, he was cold. He sat up, turned back the covers and the sheet, and crawled under. Fighting for his life, losing, the creature on top of him frenzied as it tried to tear his throat out, the only thing keeping Ethan alive, the crushing grip he had around the monster's neck, squeezing, squeezing, but the thing had pure brute strength. He could feel the hard ripples of muscle as his fingers dug into the milky, translucent skin, but he wasn't stopping it, his triceps beginning to cramp and his arms bending back as the face, the teeth, inched closer. Ethan bolted up in bed, dripping with sweat, gasping for breath, his heart racing so fast it was less like beating than a steady shuddering in his chest. He had no concept of where he was until he saw the painting of the cowboys and the campfire. The alarm clock on the bedside table changed to 3:17. He turned on the light, stared at the phone. 2:06. 2:06. How could he not remember his home landline, or even Teresa's cell? How was that possible? Swinging his legs over the side of the bed, he stood and walked over to the window. Split the blinds, looked down at the quiet street below.
dark buildings, empty sidewalks, thinking, tomorrow will be better. He'd get his phone back, his wallet, his gun, his briefcase, call his wife, his son, call Seattle and talk with Zach Hassler, get back to the investigation that had brought him here in the first place. Chapter 3. He woke to a headache and sunlight streaming into his room through the gap in the blinds. Rolled over, stared at the alarm clock. Shit. 12:21. He'd slept past noon. Ethan crawled out of bed, and as he reached for his pants, balled up on the floor, he heard someone knocking on his door. Revise that. Someone had been knocking on his door for quite a while, and he was just realizing for the first time that the distant pounding wasn't solely confined to his head. "Mr. Burke! Mr. Burke!" Lisa, the front desk clerk, shouting through his door. "Just a sec," he called out. He pulled his pants on and staggered over to the door, undid the locks, the chain, tugged it open. "Yes?" Ethan asked. "Checkout is at 11. Sorry, I... What happened to first thing? I didn't realize. Have you been able to get your wallet yet?" "No, I'm just now waking up. Is it really after 12? She wouldn't answer, just glared at him. "I'm going to the sheriff's office right now," he said. "And as soon as I get, I need your key back, and I need you to evacuate the room." "To what? Evacuate the room? Get out? I don't appreciate being taken advantage of, Mr. Burke." "No one's taking advantage of you. I'm waiting." Ethan took a hard look into her face, searching for something, softness, cracks in her resolve, but he didn't find a shred of compassion. "Just let me get dressed." He started to close the door, but she put her foot across the threshold. "Oh, you want to watch me? Really?" He backed away into the room. "Fine. Enjoy the show." And she did, stood in the doorway watching him lace up the shoes over his bare feet, button his stained white Oxford, and struggle for 2 agonizing minutes to knot his tie. When he'd finally slid his arms into his black jacket, he grabbed the room key off his bedside table and dropped it into her open palm on the way out. Said, "You're gonna feel terrible about this in 2 hours," as he walked down the corridor toward the stairs. At the drugstore on the corner of Main and 6th, Ethan grabbed a bottle of aspirin off the shelf and carried it up to the register. "I can't pay for this," he said as he set it down on the counter. "But I promise I will be right back here with my wallet in 30 minutes. It's a long story, but I have a headache from hell, and I've got to take something right now." The white-jacketed pharmacist had been in the midst of filling a prescription, counting out pills on a plastic tray. He lowered his chin and looked at Ethan over the top of his square, silver-framed glasses. "What exactly is it that you're asking me?" The pharmacist was a balding man on the depressing side of 40, pale, thin, with large brown eyes that looked even larger through his thick-as-plate glass lenses. "To help me out? I am really hurting here." "So go to the hospital. I run a pharmacy, not a credit and loan." A flash of double vision jarred Ethan for a split second, and he could feel that terrible throbbing beginning to crank up again at the base of his neck, each pulse sending a wave of stunning pain down his spine. He didn't remember leaving the pharmacy. Next thing he knew, he was stumbling down the sidewalk of Main. Feeling worse by the minute, wondering if he should go back to the hospital, but that was the last thing he wanted. He just needed some goddamn Advil, something to take the edge off the pain so he could function. Ethan stopped at the next crosswalk, tried to reorient himself to the direction he needed to go to reach the sheriff's office when he remembered. Sliding his hand into the inner pocket of his jacket, he pulled out the slip of paper and unfolded it. 604 First Avenue. He was dubious. Knock on this perfect stranger's door and ask for medicine? On the other hand, he didn't want to go to the hospital, and he couldn't show up at the sheriff's office in the throes of this mind-crippling headache. He was planning to chew some ass, and that usually went better when you weren't overcome by the desire to crawl up into a fetal position in a dark room. What was her name? That's right, Beverly. She'd probably closed last night, which meant there was a good chance she was home now. Hell, she'd offered. He could swing by, borrow a few pills, get this headache under control before heading over to the sheriff's. He crossed the street, stayed on Main until he'd reached 9th, and then took a turn around the block and headed east. Streets intersected Main. Avenues ran parallel. Figured he had about 7 blocks to walk. After the third, he could feel his feet rubbing raw, but he didn't stop. It was pain, but a welcome distraction from the pounding in his head. The school occupied an entire city block between 5th and 4th Avenues, and he limped alongside a chain-link fence that enclosed a playing field. It was recess hour for a class of 8 or 9-year-olds, and they were engaged in an elaborate game of freeze tag, a girl with blonde pigtails chasing everyone in sight as a choir of screams echoed between the brick buildings. Ethan watched their game, trying not to think about the blood that had begun to collect in his shoes, cold between his toes. Blonde pigtails suddenly stopped in the middle of a group of kids and stared at Ethan. For a moment, the other kids continued running and screaming, but gradually, they also stopped, taking notice. First, that their pursuer was no longer chasing them, and then, of what had stolen her attention. One by one, each child turned and stared at Ethan, blank expressions that he could have sworn contained some element of thinly veiled hostility. He smiled through the pain, gave a little wave. "Hey, kids." Not a single one of them waved back or otherwise responded. They just stood frozen in place like a collection of figurines, only their heads turning as they watched him pass out of sight around the corner of the gymnasium. "Weird little shits," Ethan muttered under his breath as their laughter and screams started up again, the game resuming. On the other side of 4th Avenue, he picked up the pace, the pain in his feet getting more intense, but he pushed through it, thinking, just get there, grin and bear it and get there. Beyond 3rd Avenue now, and he was jogging, his ribs beginning to ache again. He passed a series of houses that looked more run down. The seedy side of Wayward Pines, he wondered. Could such a town have a bad side? At 1st Avenue he stopped. The road had gone to dirt, the gravel long since worn away and the lumpy grade of it heavily washboarded. There was no sidewalk and there was no road beyond this one. He'd come to the eastern edge of Wayward Pines, and behind the houses that lined this street, civilization came to an abrupt end. A steep hillside, wooded with pines, ran up several hundred feet to the base of that cirque that enclosed the town. Ethan limped down the middle of the empty dirt road. He could hear birds chirping in the nearby woods and nothing else. Completely isolated from what little bustle downtown Wayward Pines could muster. He was passing mailboxes that were already in the 500s, feeling the first glimmer of relief knowing Beverly's place would be on the next block. The lightheadedness was threatening again, waves of it, gentle so far, washing over him. The next intersection stood completely empty. Not a soul out. A warm wind sliding down off the mountain sent little whirlwinds of dust across the street. There it was. 604, the second house on the right. He could tell this from the tiny steel plate that had been screwed into what was left of the mailbox, which was completely covered in rust except for the gaping, jagged holes. A quiet tweeping emitted from within, and for a moment he thought it might be another speaker, but then he glimpsed the wing of the bird that was nesting inside. He looked up at the house itself. It had probably been a lovely two-story Victorian once, with a steeply pitched roof and a porch with a swing and a stone path leading through the front yard to the entrance. The paint had long ago chipped away. Even standing in the street, Ethan could see that not even a fleck of it lingered. The boards still attached to the listing frame had been bleached almost white by the sun, most in the final stages of disintegration from rot. Not a jag of window glass remained. He pulled the ticket from last night's dinner out of his pocket and rechecked the address. The handwriting was clear, 604 First Avenue, but maybe Beverly had transposed the numbers or written Avenue when she meant street. Ethan pushed his way into the waist-high weeds that had overtaken the front yard, only flashes of the stone pathway visible through the undergrowth. The two steps leading to the covered porch looked like they'd been run through a wood chipper. He stepped up and over them onto a floorboard, his weight upon it producing a deafening creak. Beverly? The house seemed to swallow his voice. He carefully crossed the porch, stepped through the doorless doorway, and called her name again. He could hear the wind pushing against the house, its timber frame groaning. Three steps into the living room, he stopped. Springs lay rusting on the floor amid the crumbling frame of an ancient sofa. A coffee table stood covered in cobwebs, and underneath them the pages of some magazine, sodden and rotted beyond recognition. Beverly couldn't have wanted him to come here, not even as a joke. She must have accidentally written down the wrong... The smell brought his chin up. He took a tentative step forward, dodging a trio of nails sticking up through a floorboard. Sniffed the air again. Another blast of it swept by as a gust of wind shook the house, and he instantly buried his nose in the crook of his arm. He moved forward, past half a staircase, into a narrow hallway that ran between the kitchen and the dining room, where a cascade of light streamed down onto the splintered remains of where the ceiling had crushed the dinner table. He went on, picking his way through a minefield of bad boards and outright holes that gaped into the crawl space under the house. The refrigerator, the sink, the stove, rust covered every metal surface like a fungus, this place reminding him of the old homesteads he and his friends would stumble across on summer explorations into the woods behind their farms. Abandoned barns and cabins, the roofs perforated with holes that the sun blazed through in tubes of light. He'd once found a 50-year-old newspaper inside an old desk, announcing the election of a new president, had wanted to take it home and show his parents, but the thing was so brittle it had flaked apart in his hands. Ethan hadn't ventured a breath through his nose in over a minute, and still he could tell the stench was getting stronger. Swore he could taste it in the corners of his mouth, and the sheer intensity of it, worse than ammonia, was drawing tears from his eyes. The far end of the hallway grew dark, still protected under a ceiling that dripped from the last good rain, whenever that had been. The door at the end of the hall was closed. Ethan blinked the tears out of his eyes and reached down for the doorknob, but there wasn't one. He nudged the door open with his shoe. Hinges grinding. The door banged into the wall and Ethan took a step forward across the threshold. Just like his memory of those old homesteads, bullets of light shot through holes in the far wall, glinting off the labyrinth of cobwebs before striking the only piece of furniture in the room. The metal frame was still standing, and through the soupy ruin of the mattress, he could see the bedsprings like coiled copperheads. He hadn't heard the flies until now, because they had congregated inside the man's mouth, a metropolis of them. The sound of their collective buzzing like a small outboard motor. He'd seen worse in combat, but he'd never smelled worse. White showed through everywhere, the wrist and ankle bones which had been handcuffed to the headboard, and the iron railing at the base of the bed. Where his right leg was exposed, the flesh looked almost shredded. The internal architecture on the left side of the man's face was exposed, right down to the roots of his teeth. His stomach had bloated too. Ethan could see the swell of it underneath the tattered suit, which was black and single-breasted. Just like his. Though the face was a wreck, the hair length and color were right. The height was a match, too. Ethan staggered back and leaned against the doorframe. Jesus fucking Christ. This was Agent Evans. Back outside on the front porch of the abandoned house, Ethan bent over, his hands braced against his knees, and took deep, penetrating breaths through his nose to purge the smell. But it wouldn't leave. That death stink had embedded in his sinus cavity and as a bitter, putrid bite in the back of his throat. He took off his jacket and unbuttoned his shirt, fought his way out of the sleeves. The stench was in the fibers of his clothing now. Shirtless, he moved through the riot of undergrowth that had once been a front yard and finally reached the dirt road. He could feel the coldness of raw skin on the backs of his feet and the bass throb in his skull, but the pain had lost its edge to pure adrenaline. He set off at a strong pace down the middle of the street, his mind racing. He'd been tempted to search the pockets of the dead man's coat and pants, see if he could score a wallet, some ID, but the smart play had been to hold off, to not touch anything. Let people with latex gloves and face masks and every conceivable state-of-the-art forensic tool descend on that room. He still couldn't wrap his head around it. A federal agent had been murdered in this little slice of heaven. He was no coroner, but he felt certain Evans's face wasn't just rotting away. Part of his skull had been caved in, teeth broken out, one of his eyes MIA. He'd been tortured, too. The 6 blocks seemed to fly by, and then he was jogging up the sidewalk to the entrance of the sheriff's office. He left his jacket and shirt outside on a bench and pulled open one of the double doors. The reception area was a wood-paneled room with brown carpeting and taxidermied animal heads mounted on every available piece of vertical real estate. At the front desk, a 60-something woman with long, silver hair was playing solitaire with a physical deck of cards. The freestanding nameplate on her desk read, Belinda Moran. Ethan arrived at the edge of her desk and watched her lay down 4 more cards before finally tearing herself away from the game.
May I help?
Her eyes went wide. She looked him up and down, wrinkling her nose at what he supposed was the god-awful stench of human decay that must be wafting off him.
You're not wearing a shirt, she said.
United States Secret Service Special Agent Ethan Burke here to see the sheriff. What's his name?
Who?
The sheriff?
Oh, Pope. Sheriff Arnold Pope.
Is he in, Belinda? Instead of answering his question, she lifted her rotary phone and dialed a 3-digit extension.
Hi, Arnie. There's a man here to see you. Says he's a secret agent or something.
Special agent with the... She held up a finger.
I don't know, Arnie. He isn't wearing a shirt, and he...
She turned away from Ethan in her swivel chair, whispered,
Smells bad. Really bad.
Okay. Okay, I'll tell him. She spun back around and hung up the phone.
Sheriff Pope will be with you shortly.
I need to see him right now.
I understand that. You can wait over there.
She pointed to a grouping of chairs in a nearby corner. Ethan hesitated for a moment and then finally turned and headed toward the waiting area. Wise to keep the first encounter civil. In his experience, local law enforcement became defensive and even hostile when feds threw their weight around right out of the gate. In light of what he'd found in that abandoned house, he was going to be working with this guy for the foreseeable future. Better to start off with the glad hand than a middle finger. Ethan eased down into one of the 4 upholstered chairs in the sitting area. He'd worked up a sweat on the jog over, but now that his heart rate had returned to baseline, the layer of sweat on his bare skin had begun to chill him as the central air blew down out of a vent overhead. There wasn't much in the way of current reading material on the small table in front of his chair, just a few old issues of National Geographic and Popular Science. He leaned back in the chair and shut his eyes. The pain in his head was coming back,
the cut of each throb escalating on some molecular level, perceptible only over a span of minutes. He could actually hear the pounding of his headache in the total silence of the sheriff's office, where there was no sound other than the flipping of cards. He heard Belinda say, "Yes," opened his eyes in time to see her place the last card, having won her game. She gathered the cards up and shuffled them and began again. Another 5 minutes passed. Another 10. Belinda finished the game, and she was mixing the deck again, when Ethan noted the first impulse of irritation, a twitch in his left eye. The pain was still growing, and he'd now been waiting, at his estimation, for 15 minutes. In that increment of time, the phone had not rung once, and not another soul had entered the building. He shut his eyes and counted down from 60 as he massaged his temples. When he opened them again, he was still sitting there shirtless and cold, and Belinda was still turning cards over, and the sheriff had yet to come. Ethan stood, fought a bout of wooziness for 10 seconds before finally establishing his balance. He walked back over to the reception desk and waited for Belinda to look up. She laid down 5 cards before acknowledging him.
"Yes?"
"I'm sorry to be a bother, but I've been waiting about 20 minutes now. The sheriff's real busy today." "I'm sure he is. But I need to speak with him right away. Now you can either get him on the phone again and tell him I'm done waiting, or I'm going to walk back there myself and..." Her desk phone rang. She answered.
"Yes?"
"Okay, I sure will." She shelved the phone and smiled up at Ethan. "You're welcome to go on back now. Right down that hallway. His office is through the door at the very end." Ethan knocked beneath the nameplate. A deep voice hollered from the other side.
"Yep."
He turned the knob, pushed the door open, stepped inside. The floor of the office was a dark and deeply scuffed hard wood. To his left, the enormous head of an elk had been mounted to the wall opposite a large, rustic desk. Behind the desk stood 3 antique gun cabinets, brimming with rifles, shotguns, handguns, and what he calculated were enough boxes of ammo to execute every resident of this little town 3 times over. A man 10 years his senior reclined in a leather chair, his cowboy-booted feet propped up on the desk. He had wavy blonde hair that would probably be white within a decade, and his jaw was frosted with a few days' worth of grizzle. Dark brown canvas pants, long-sleeved button-down, hunter green. The sheriff's star gleamed under the lights. It looked like solid brass, intricately etched with the letters WP inset in black in the center. As he approached the desk, Ethan thought he saw the sheriff let slip a private smirk. "Ethan Burke, Secret Service." He extended his hand across the desk, and the sheriff hesitated, as if holding some internal debate over whether he felt like moving. Finally, he slid his boots off the desktop and leaned forward in his chair.
"Arnold Pope."
They shook hands.
"Have a seat, Ethan."
Ethan eased down into one of the straight-backed wooden chairs.
"How you feeling?"
Pope asked.
"I've been better."
"I'll bet. You've probably smelled better, too."
Pope flashed a quick grin.
"Rough accident you had a couple days ago. Tragic."
"Yeah, I was hoping to learn a few more details about that. Who hit us?"
"Eyewitnesses say it was a tow truck."
"Driver in custody? Being charged?"
"Would be if I could find him."
"You saying this was a hit and run?" Pope nodded.
"Hauled ass out of town after he T-boned you." "Long gone by the time I reached the scene."
"And no one got a license plate or anything?" Pope shook his head and lifted something off the desk, a snow globe with a gold base. The miniature buildings under the glass dome became caught in a whirlwind of snow as he passed the globe back and forth between his hands.
"What efforts are being made to locate this truck?" Ethan asked.
"We got stuff in the works."
"You do?"
"You bet."
"I'd like to see Agent Stallings."
His body is being held in the morgue.
And where's that?
In the basement of the hospital.
It suddenly came to Ethan, out of the blue, like someone had whispered it into his ear.
Could I borrow a piece of paper? Ethan asked.
Pope opened a drawer and peeled a post-it note off the top of a pack and handed it to Ethan along with a pen. Ethan scooted his chair forward and set the post-it on the desktop, scribbled down the number.
I understand you have my things, Ethan said as he slipped the post-it into his pocket.
What things?
My cell, gun, wallet, badge, briefcase.
Who told you I had those?
A nurse at the hospital.
No clue where she got that idea.
Wait, so you don't have my things?
No.
Ethan stared at Pope across the desk.
Is it possible they're still in the car?
Which car?
He struggled to keep the tone of his voice in check.
The one the tow truck hit while I was in it?
I suppose it's possible, but I'm fairly certain the EMTs took your things.
Jesus.
What?
Nothing. Would you mind if I made a few phone calls before I leave? I haven't talked to my wife in days.
I spoke to her.
When?
Day of the accident.
Is she on her way?
I have no idea. I just let her know what had happened.
I also need to call my sack.
Who's that?
Adam Hassler.
He sent you here?
That's right.
Did he also instruct you not to bother calling me ahead of time to let me know the feds would be rolling up in my world? Or was that all you?
You think I had some obligation to—
Courtesy, Ethan. Courtesy. Then again, being a fed, maybe you aren't familiar with the concept.
I would have contacted you eventually, Mr. Pope. There was no intent to cut you out of the loop.
Oh. Well, in that case—
Ethan hesitated, wanting to be clear, to communicate the information he wished to impart, and not a shred more. But his head was killing him, and the double vision threatened to split the sheriff into two assholes.
I was sent here to find two Secret Service agents.
Pope's eyebrows came up.
They're missing?
For 11 days now.
What were they doing in Wayward Pines?
I wasn't provided a detailed briefing on their investigation, although I know it involved David Pilcher.
Name sounds vaguely familiar. Who is he?
He always shows up on lists of the world's richest men. One of these reclusive billionaires. Never talks to the press. Owns a bunch of biopharmaceutical companies.
And he has a connection to Wayward Pines?
Again, I don't know that. But if the Secret Service was here, there was probably some investigation involving a financial crime. That's all I know.
Pope stood suddenly. Ethan could tell he was a large man sitting behind the desk, but standing in his boots, Ethan saw that he was an inch or two shy of 6.5 feet.
You're welcome to use the phone in the conference room, Agent Burke.
Ethan didn't move from his chair. I wasn't quite finished, Sheriff.
Conference room's right this way.
Pope came around his desk and started toward the door.
And maybe a shirt next time? Just a suggestion.
The pounding in Ethan's head was becoming laced with anger.
Would you like to know why I'm not wearing a shirt, Sheriff?
Not particularly.
One of the agents I came looking for is decomposing in a house 6 blocks from here.
Pope stopped at the door, his back to Ethan.
I just found him before coming here, Ethan said.
Pope turned and glared down at Ethan.
Elaborate on, I just found him.
Last night, a bartender at the Biergarten gave me her address in case I needed anything. I woke up this morning with a terrible headache, no money, got kicked out of my hotel room. I went to her house to get some medicine for my headache, only the address she gave was wrong or something.
What's the address?
604 First Avenue. It turned out to be an old abandoned house, in ruins. Agent Evans had been chained to a bed in one of the rooms.
You are sure it's this man you came here to find?
80% sure. There was a great deal of decay, and his face had suffered extensive blunt force trauma. The scowl the sheriff had maintained since Ethan had walked into his office disappeared, and his features seemed to soften. He walked toward Ethan and eased down into the empty chair beside him.
"I apologize, Agent Burke. I kept you waiting out in reception. I got angry that you didn't call before coming to town, and, well, you're right. There was no obligation. I've got a nasty temper, one of my many failings, and my behavior was unacceptable."
"Apology accepted."
"You've had a rough couple of days."
"I have."
"Go make your phone calls, and we'll talk when you're finished."
A long table crowded the conference room, with barely enough space between the chairs and the wall for Ethan to make his way toward the rotary phone down at the end. He dug the post-it note out of his pocket and lifted the phone. Dial tone. He spun out the number. It rang. Afternoon sun slicing between the blinds and striking the table's polished wood veneer in blades of blinding light. Three rings in, he said, "Come on, baby, pick up." After the fifth ring, he got the machine. Teresa's voice.
"Hi, you've reached the Burks. Sorry we aren't here to take your call. Unless, of course, you're a telemarketer, then we're thrilled to have missed your call, and in fact, we're probably dodging it and encourage you to forget this number. Otherwise, leave it at the beep."
"Teresa, it's me. God, I feel like I haven't heard your voice in years. I guess you know that I was in a car accident out here. No one can seem to find my phone, so if you've been trying to call, I'm sorry. I'm staying at the Wayward Pines Hotel, room 226. You might try calling the sheriff's office also. I hope you and Ben are okay. I'm all right, still a little sore, but doing better. Please call me at the hotel tonight. I'll try you again soon. I love you, Teresa. So much."
He hung up the phone, sat there for a moment trying to conjure the number to his wife's cell. Got as far as the first seven digits, but the final three remained shrouded in mystery. The number to the Seattle field office came to him instantly. He dialed, and after three rings, a woman whose voice Ethan didn't recognize answered.
"Secret Service?"
"Hi, it's Ethan Burke. I need to speak with Adam Hassler, please."
"He's not available at the moment. Was there something I could help you with?"
"No, I really need to speak with him." "Is he out of the office today?"
"He's not available at the moment. Was there something I could help you with?"
"How about I try him on his cell? Could I have that number, please?"
"Oh, I'm afraid I'm not allowed to give out that information."
"Do you understand who I am? Agent Ethan Burke?"
"Was there something I could help you with? What's your name?"
"Marcy."
"You're new, right?" "This is my third day."
"Look, I am up here in Wayward Pines, Idaho, in the middle of a shitstorm. Get Hassler on the phone immediately. I don't care what he's doing. If he's in a meeting, if he's taking a shit, put him on the goddamn phone."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"What?"
"I'm not going to be able to continue this conversation with you speaking to me like that."
"Marcy?"
"Yes."
"I apologize. I'm sorry I raised my voice with you, but I have to speak with Hassler. It is urgent."
"I'd be happy to slip him a message if you'd like."
Ethan closed his eyes. He was grinding his molars together to keep from screaming through the phone.
"Tell him to call Agent Ethan Burke at the Wayward Pines Sheriff's Office or at the Wayward Pines Hotel, room 226. He has to do this the moment he gets the message. Agent Evans is dead. Do you understand me?"
"I'll give him the message,"
Marcy said brightly and hung up the phone. Ethan pulled the receiver away from his face and slammed it five times into the table. As he was hanging the phone back up, he noticed Sheriff Pope standing in the doorway to the conference room.
"Everything all right, Ethan?"
"Yeah, it's just having a little trouble getting through to my sack."
Pope came inside and closed the door. He sat down at the end of the table opposite Ethan.
"You said there were two missing agents?"
Pope asked.
"That's right."
"Tell me about the other one."
Her name's Kate Hewson. She worked out of the Boise field office, and prior to that, Seattle.
Did you know her there? We were partners. So she got transferred?
Yes.
And Kate came here with Agent Bill Evans? On this top-secret investigation.
Right.
I'd like to help. Would you like my help?
Of course, Arnold.
Okay. Let's start with the basics. What does Kate look like?
Ethan leaned back in his chair.
Kate.
He'd so thoroughly trained himself over the last year not to think of her that it took him a moment to retrieve her face, the memory of it like tearing open a wound that had just begun to scar over.
She's 5'2", 5'3", 105 pounds. Little gal, huh?
Best lawman I've ever known. Short brown hair last time I saw her, but it could have grown out. Blue eyes, uncommonly beautiful. God, he could still taste her.
Any distinguishing marks?
Yeah, actually, she has a faint birthmark on her cheek. A café au lait about the size of a nickel.
I'll put the word out to my deputies. Maybe even have a sketch of her drawn to show around town.
That'd be great.
Why did you say Kate was transferred out of Seattle?
I didn't say.
Well, do you know?
Some sort of internal reshuffling was the rumor. I'd like to see the car.
The car?
The black Lincoln Town car I was driving when the accident happened.
Oh, of course.
Where might I find that?
There's a salvage yard on the outskirts of town.
The sheriff stood.
What was that address again?
604 First Avenue. I'll walk you over.
No need.
I want to.
I don't want you to.
Why?
Was there anything else you needed?
I'd like to know the results of your investigation.
Come back tomorrow after lunch. We'll see where we're at.
And you'll take me to the salvage yard to see the car.
I think we can swing that, but for now, let's go. I'll walk you out.
Ethan's jacket and shirt smelled marginally better as he slid his arms into the sleeves and started down the street, away from the Wayward Pines sheriff's office. He still reeked, but figured the offensive smell of decay would draw less attention than a man walking around town in nothing but dress slacks. He pushed as strong a pace as he could manage, but the wooziness kept coming in waves, and his head was alive with pain, each step sending new tendrils of agony into the far reaches of his skull. The beer garden was open and empty save for one bored-looking bartender sitting on a stool behind the bar reading a paperback novel, one of F. Paul Wilson's early books. When Ethan reached the bar, he said, "Is Beverly working tonight?" The man held up a finger. 10 seconds passed as he finished reading a passage. At last, he closed the book, gave Ethan his full attention.
"What can I get you to drink?"
"Nothing. I'm looking for the woman who was tending bar here last night. Her name was Beverly, pretty brunette, mid-30s, fairly tall." The barkeep stepped down off his stool and set the book on the bar. His long, graying hair was the color of murky dishwater, and he pulled it back into a ponytail.
"You were here? In this restaurant? Last night?"
"That's correct," Ethan said.
"And you're telling me that a tall brunette was tending bar?"
"Exactly. Beverly was her name?" The man shook his head, Ethan detecting a whiff of mockery in his smile.
"There's two people on the payroll here that tend bar. Guy named Steve and me."
"No, this woman waited on me last night. I ate a burger, sat right over there." Ethan pointed to the corner stool.
"Don't take this the wrong way, buddy, but how much did you have to drink?"
"Nothing. And I'm not your buddy. I'm a federal agent, and I know that I was here last night, and I know who served me."
"Sorry, man. I don't know what to tell you. I think you must have been at a different restaurant."
No, I...
Ethan suddenly lost his focus, dug his fingertips into his temples. He could feel his pulse now in his temporal artery, each heartbeat carrying the punch of those cold headaches he used to get as a kid, that fleeting, excruciating pain that followed too ravenous a bite of popsicle or ice cream.
Sir?
Sir, are you all right?
Ethan staggered back from the bar, managed to say,
She was here, I know it. I don't know why you're doing...
Then he was standing outside, his hands on his knees, bent over a pool of vomit on the sidewalk that he quickly surmised had come from him, his throat burning from the bile. Ethan straightened up, wiped his mouth across the sleeve of his jacket. The sun had already dropped behind the cliffs, the coolness of evening upon the town. There were things he needed to do. Find Beverly, find the EMTs, and recover his personal belongings, but all he wanted was to curl up in bed in a dark room, sleep off the pain, the confusion, and the base emotion underlying it all that was getting harder and harder to ignore. Terror. The strengthening sense that something was very, very wrong. He stumbled up the stone steps and pushed through the doors into the hotel. The fireplace warmed the lobby. A young couple occupied one of the love seats by the hearth, sipping from glasses of sparkling wine. On a romantic vacation, he figured, enjoying a completely different side of Wayward Pines. A tuxedoed man sat at the grand piano, playing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Ethan arrived at the front desk, forcing himself to smile through the pain. The same clerk who'd evicted him from his room that morning started speaking even before she looked up.
"Welcome to the Wayward Pines Hotel. How may I help?"
She stopped when she saw Ethan.
"Hi, Lisa."
"I'm impressed," she said.
"Impressed?"
"You came back to pay. You told me you would, but I honestly didn't think I'd ever see you again."
"I apologize for..."
"No, listen, I wasn't able to find my wallet today." "You mean you haven't come back to pay for your room last night? Like you promised me you were going to multiple times?"
Ethan shut his eyes, breathing through the exquisite pain.
"Lisa, you cannot imagine the day I've had. I just need to lie down for a few hours. I don't even need a room for the whole night, just a place to clear my head and sleep. I'm in so much pain."
"Hold on."
She slid off her chair and leaned toward him across the counter.
"You still can't pay, and now you're asking me for another room?"
"I don't have anywhere else to go."
"You lied to me."
"I'm sorry. I really thought I would have it by..."
"Do you understand that I went out on a limb for you? That I could lose my job?"
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean..."
"Go."
"Excuse me?"
"Did you not hear me?"
"I don't have any place to go, Lisa. I don't have a phone, I have no money, I haven't eaten since last night, and..."
"Explain to me again how any of this is my problem."
"I just need to lie down for a few hours. I am begging you."
"Look, I've explained this to you as clearly as I possibly can. It's time for you to leave."
Ethan didn't move. He just stared at her, hoping she might see the agony in his eyes, take pity.
"Now,"
she said. He raised his hands in a gesture of surrender, backing away from the counter. As he reached the doors, Lisa called after him.
"I don't want to see you back in here ever again."
Ethan nearly fell descending the steps, his head spinning by the time he reached the sidewalk. The street lamps and the lights from passing cars began to swirl, Ethan noting the strength flooding out of his legs like someone had pulled a drain plug. Regardless, he started up the sidewalk, saw that red brick building looming up the street 8 blocks away. There was still fear of it, but now he needed the hospital. Wanted the bed, the sleep, the meds, anything to stop this pain. He was either going to the hospital, or he was sleeping outside, in an alley or a park, exposed to the elements.
But it was 8 blocks, so far, each step now requiring a crushing expenditure of energy, and the lights were disintegrating all around him, swirling, long tails getting more intense, more pronounced, skewing his vision as if he could see the world only as a long exposure shot of a city at night, the car lights stretching into rods of brilliance, the street lamps burning like blowtorches. He bumped into someone. A man pushed him, said, "Do you drive that way?" At the next intersection, Ethan stopped, doubtful he could make it across. He stumbled back and sat down hard on the sidewalk against a building. The street had become crowded. He couldn't see anything distinctly, but he could hear footsteps moving by on the concrete and snippets of passing conversation. He lost all sense of time. He might have dreamed. Then he was lying on his side on the cold concrete, felt someone's breath, their voice right in his face. Words came at him, though he couldn't assemble them into any sensible order. He opened his eyes. Night had fallen. He was shivering. A woman knelt beside him, and he felt her hands gripping his shoulders. She was shaking him, speaking to him.
"Sir, are you all right? Can you hear me? Sir, can you look at me and tell me what's wrong?"
"He's drunk," a man's voice.
"No, Harold, he's sick."
Ethan tried to pull her face into focus, but it was dark and blurry, and all he could see were those street lamps shining like minor suns across the road and the occasional streak of light from a passing car.
"My head hurts," he said in a voice that sounded far too weak and pained and fear-filled to be his. "I need help."
She took his hand and told him not to worry, not to be afraid, that help was already on the way. And though the hand holding his clearly didn't belong to a young woman, the skin too taut and thin like old paper, there was something so familiar in the voice that it broke his heart. Chapter 4. They took the Bainbridge Island ferry out of Seattle and headed north up the peninsula toward Port Angeles, a convoy of 4 cars carrying 15 of the Burke's closest friends. Teresa had been hoping for a pretty day, but it was cold, gray rain. The Olympics obscured, and nothing visible beyond their narrow corridor of highway. But none of that mattered. They were going regardless of the weather, and if no one else wanted to join her, she and Ben would hike up alone. Her friend Darla drove, Teresa in the back seat, holding her 7-year-old son's hand and staring out the rain-beaded glass as the rainforest streaked past in a blur of dark green. A few miles west of town on Highway 112, they reached the trailhead to Striped Peak. It was still overcast, but the rain had stopped. They started out in silence, hiking along the water, no sound but the impact of their footfalls squishing in the mud and the white noise of the breakers. Teresa glanced down into a cove as the trail passed above it, the water not as blue as she remembered, blaming the cloud cover for muting the color, no failing of her memory. The group passed the World War II bunkers and climbed through groves of fern and then into forest. Moss everywhere, the trees still dripping, lushness even in early winter. They neared the top. The entire time, no one had spoken. Teresa could feel a burning in her legs and the tears coming. It started to rain as they reached the summit. Nothing heavy, just a few wild drops blowing sideways in the wind. Teresa walked out into the meadow. She was crying now. On a clear day, the view would have been for miles, with the sea 1,000 feet below. Today, the peak was socked in. She crumpled down in the wet grass, put her head between her knees, and cried. There was the pattering of drizzle on the hood of her poncho and nothing else. Ben sat down beside her, and she put her arm around him, said,
"You did good hiking, buddy. How you feeling?" "All right, I guess." "Is this it?" "Yeah, this is it." You could see a lot farther if it wasn't for the fog. What do we do now?
She wiped her eyes, took a deep, trembling breath.
Now, I'm going to say some things about your dad. Maybe some other people will, too. Do I have to? Only if you want to. I don't want to.
That's fine.
It doesn't mean I don't still love him. I know that. Would he want me to talk about him?
Not if it made you feel uncomfortable. Teresa shut her eyes, took a moment to gather herself. She struggled onto her feet. Her friends were milling around in the ferns, blowing into their hands for warmth. It was raw up on the summit, a strong gale pushing the ferns in green waves and the air cold enough to turn their breath to steam. She called her friends over and they all stood in a huddle against the rain and the wind. Teresa told the story of how she and Ethan had taken a trip to the peninsula several months after they'd started dating. They stayed at a B&B in Port Angeles and, late one afternoon, stumbled upon the trailhead to Striped Peak. They reached the summit at sunset on a clear, calm evening, and as she stared across the strait at the long view into southern Canada, Ethan dropped to one knee and proposed. He'd bought a toy ring from a convenience store vending machine that morning. Said he hadn't been planning anything like this, but that he'd realized on this trip that he wanted to spend the rest of his life with her. Told her he'd never been happier than in this moment, standing on the top of this mountain and the world spread out beneath them.
I hadn't been planning anything like it either, Teresa said. But I said yes, and we stayed up there and watched the sun go into the sea. Ethan and I always talked about coming back here for a weekend, but you know what they say about life and making other plans. Anyway, we had our perfect moments.
She kissed the top of her son's head.
And our not-so-perfect ones. But I think Ethan was never happier, never more carefree and hopeful about the future than that sunset on the top of this mountain 13 years ago. As you know, the circumstances surrounding his disappearance.
She pushed back against the storm of emotion that was waiting, always waiting.
Well, we don't really have a body or ashes or anything. But,
a smile through the tears,
I did bring this.
She dug an old plastic ring out of her pocket, the gold paint of the band long since flaked away, the flimsy prongs still holding the emerald-colored prism of glass. Some of the others were crying now, too.
He did eventually get me a diamond, but it seemed appropriate, if not more cost-efficient, to bring this.
She pulled a garden spade out of her wet backpack.
I want to leave something close to Ethan here, and this feels right. Ben, would you help me?
Teresa knelt down and swept away the ferns until she saw the ground. It was saturated from the rain, and the spade speared through easily. She dug out several chunks of earth and then let Ben do the same.
I love you, Ethan,
she whispered.
And I miss you so much.
Then she dropped the ring into the shallow grave and covered it with the upturned earth and leveled it off with the back of the blade. That night, back at their home in Upper Queen Anne, Teresa threw a party. Packed the